The earth shook with a mighty tremor, great chasms appeared in the once beautiful garden land. Yawning crevasses sucked in their quota of human carnage. The invisible force whipped the ocean waters into a foaming fury, and great tidal waves like the tongue of a ravenous beast swept the human creations and the human creators alike into the jaws of abysmal nothingness. For months the destruction went on, until at last Lemuria was known no more. Only a calm sea and a few of the higher mountain peaks gave tribute to a land that once had been. Then, although no mortal ear could have heard the message that the ethers carried, there rose the sound of victorious yet hollow laughter and the words, "What now, O God of the universe? You sent your angel's deputy to save these children, but he has failed. They destroyed themselves rather than return to you. I, Satan, have been their leader. But only the insistent solitude, the imperturbable calm of untroubled consciousness gave answer to the voice, 'I will wait, Lucifer, till they come to me of their free will. I will wait.'" And so the satanic force proceeded on. From race to race, from land to land did Lucifer, working through human form, sow dragon's teeth of selfishness, of hate, of pride, of greed that later would destroy all mankind. There was the highly developed civilization of Atlanta which, like Lemuria, was eventually destroyed. Where Lemuria had turned to the selfish worship of beauty and art, Atlanta became a worshipper of commercialism. Competition was born, and individual enterprises divided men in thought and action. What great wizards of commerce we are, what outstanding financiers, what leaders of industry, the people said. We have builded a civilization that will stand forever. Then amid the human pride of accomplishment was heard again the voice of a prophet. Atlanta, you have gone to an extreme in commercialism, your nation is on the edge of a precipice. You have forgotten your real self, gold is your god. The law of the cosmos is unity, yet you have divided yourselves, each man against his brother. Can you not perceive that such a state must bring eventual destruction? The words were almost drowned out by a rush of commerce, the stranger said. The few who heard shook their heads and muttered, one to another, "He is behind the times, poor man. He does not understand progress. Competition is the power that stimulates greater activity." But Atlantu is gone, eliminated by the hand of nature. The voice of the stranger continued on, retouching old threads in the tapestry of memory. Egypt, also, was once a promising land, composed as it was of four distinct races of men, bespeaking in that very fact a sense of brotherhood and mutual understanding. It was, in its early days, well balanced as to material and so-called spiritual expression, but, with its gradual fusion with other races, of which there were at least 12, religious complications took place. Each race had its individual conception of deity, all of which were expressions of a personal rather than cosmic nature. Eventually all economic, scientific and commercial activities had to be placed on the shelf, while the many people of Egypt fought to the death to uphold their favorite gods and goddesses, of whom there were not less than 450. Egypt now rests in the tomb of religious intolerance and superstition. The page of memory is turned, and now to the sound of clanking steel and the beat of marching feet, to the cries of dying men, through the haze of bloodlust and brutal savagery rises the Roman Empire, Rome in all the dubious glory of military dictatorship. Above the agonies of human flesh borne by piercing sword and cut by Roman whips rises a voice, calm and compassionate, "As ye would that men should do unto you, do even unto them." But the ears of the people were deaf, their eyes blind, their hearts turned to stone, and the glory of ancient Rome is but a page in history. The stranger paused now and studied his listeners for a moment, then continued, "You who are gathered here tonight may well represent our past. The world today is on the brink of a chasm such as none of these civilizations have ever known. All of our past mistakes are summed up in this present age." He gestured toward the scientist, "We have gone far in mastering the elements, we have gone far in perverting that knowledge. We are inflated with the pride of our creative genius. We have turned the knowledge of chemical action into fields of destruction, using that understanding for selfish purposes. We have mastered the elements, but not ourselves. His gaze rested upon the industrial leader. "We are slaves to commerce. Competition is becoming keener and more underhanded every day. It is becoming merely a case of dog-eat-dog in the business world. Every man is against his brother. And you," he said, pointing to the minister, "you and your order who should be leading men back to the Father represent nothing more than religious divisions and intolerance. You should be a brother to all men. Here we have in one group the story of lost civilizations, but what will the men of today profit by the experiences of the past? Will they let those lessons save them from present destruction? Will they as individuals heed the voice of that one true messenger of God who rose above Satan's influence? Not I but the Father doeth the work." "What I see? The Father doeth? Do you mean to tell us," questioned the scientist, "that what we term progress is wrong, that we should be satisfied with an ox cart when we can have all of our present modern means of transportation, or that we should turn to the ministrations of the witch doctor when we have so many practical, scientific means of alleviating human suffering? Or that we should tear down our churches and allow the people to become atheists?" broke in the minister. "Perhaps you would have us close our factories and business houses, do away with our monetary system and revert to the practice of hunting berries for food." The army officer interrupted the captain of industry. "Yes, and dismiss our armies and navies. What nation do you think would dare do such a thing? Any country as crazy as that would certainly be very quickly torn to bits and devoured by the rest of the world. No, I think that we had better stick to the law of self-preservation by preparedness." The jaded bookkeeper in a tone of injured meekness put in his word of protest. "You expect men who have spent their time and energy in preparing themselves to perform certain work to give up their jobs to incompetents who have drifted along and exerted no personal effort to attain success in any field of endeavor. Every man has an equal chance. Are we responsible for those who have not the initiative to be outstanding workmen? The best man will always win. Survival of the fittest is nature's law." The stranger sat with bowed head, silent before this barrage of protests. "My friends," he said, "I have allowed you to represent the past mistakes of humankind. You have done it well. The thought of each of you has gone to an extreme in your individual phase of expression, just as the civilizations of the past have done. I could not deny you the right of progress in any field, for that would be contrary to cosmic laws. I only suggest that the progress be turned to a common good instead of individual benefit. I suggest that you do unto others as you would have them do unto you, that you express that feeling of kindness which you now hold prisoner in the stony dungeon of your hearts. And if I take your God from you, I give you in its stead an impersonal creator that is the same to all men, a creative power that knows no good nor evil, right or wrong, the law of cause and effect that says, as ye sow ye shall also reap. The principle of action and reaction that demands or asks nothing of man except a perfect balance in all phases of life." The soldier rose. "I am afraid, sir, that you are too idealistic for the present age. You will forgive me if I retire?" The other five rose also and bade the stranger good night. He sat alone before the dying embers of a once brilliantly flaming fire. Poor mortal slaves! It is such as these that I would free from bondage. A sound of laughter floated back to him from the departing men of the world. It bore a taunting quality of derision in its tone. And then silence, calm, imperturbable silence that in its very act of insistent calmness seemed to dissolve the coarseness of all sound and yet to give the impression of a thought as old as time. "I will wait. I will wait." 2. Conclusion. In conclusion, I sincerely hope this book has answered many of the reader's questions on flying saucers and space people, as well as establishing my own position in this field of exploration. My preliminary studies, which began with the advent of flying saucers, have now been completed. Of course, this does not mean I intend to abandon the subject, but it does mean that a new program of greater intellectual expansion, along technical and philosophical lines, will be carried out by myself and my associates. The knowledge shared by our space brothers must now be put to work. I have been advised to proceed in two fields that are vital to our progress: space philosophy and technology, which, we will learn, are inseparable in establishing a peaceful, productive society. The information conveyed to us must be put to peaceful, productive use, that we might in time achieve the same dignified existence enjoyed by men of other planets. I would like very much to hear from the readers, as to their opinions and personal conclusions on the philosophy and technology contained in this book. I would also like to convey the thought that from now on, we will be receiving additional data which probably will not be released through official channels, information which will be instrumental in charting the individual's path of progress. Future studies being planned at the time of this writing include a detailed exploration of man's place in the cosmos, and his eternal identity as the infinite man. End.